Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Matt Zeller. In 2008, Matt spent 8 months in Afghanistan as an Army lieutenant and an embedded trainer with Afghan security forces in the Ghazni province. He has also worked for the CIA and in 2010 was the Democratic Party nominee for New York's 29th congressional district in the Southern Tier, ultimately losing to Republican Tom Reed. Matt is the author of Watches Without Time, An American Soldier in Afghanistan, a memoir of his war experiences based in large part on emails and letters he wrote while he was there. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
First, a quick plug for your book. I haven't read it all, but what I have read has made me want to read more.
Well, that's great. Thank you.
Let's start with an overview of your duties and activities in Afghanistan. Can you give me a brief summary of where you were and what you were charged with doing?
Sure. So I was a part of basically a 19-man team in Ghazni province, which is about halfway between Kabul and Kandahar. It's sort of the midway point between the two cities. And what we were charged with doing was we lived on an Afghan army base, and we were responsible for the training and development of that army battalion that was stationed there, as an Afghan army battalion, as well as the entire police force responsible for internal security within Ghazni province. And there were ultimately between the police and the army about 4,000 Afghan security forces that we were actually responsible for either getting them through their basic training or helping them become more proficient at their jobs.
And would you go out with them when they were going out on missions and fight with them?
Absolutely. We would typically spend 4 or 5 days at a time actually living at one of the police stations in the outlying district. So Afghanistan is divided into 34 provinces. Provinces are like states. Those provinces are then further divided into districts, and districts are like counties. Ghazni had, I think, 19 districts inside the province. We were assigned to focus on 4 specific districts because they were trying to secure key population and geographic centers that basically linked up with the main roads that connected major cities, because at that point the Taliban was really trying to impact our freedom of movement from town to town. So in addition to those 4 main districts that we were supposed to focus on, we had the rest of the province that we'd try and get out and visit on occasion. But we basically lived out of those police stations and would go on patrol with those police officers and sort of evaluate how well they're doing their jobs, and then trying to get them better trained and equipped to conduct their responsibilities. I'll be honest, the Afghan police are terrible. They're not ready for the task that they're being asked of. They're poorly equipped, poorly resourced. Most of the population's illiterate, so it's very hard to train an indigenous police and army that's illiterate when you're coming from a Western civilization in which you're used to training people who are literate, and therefore you can pass them documents, you can show them presentations that you just understand that they're going to naturally be able to read on their own. We did a lot of things with pictures and literally motions of hands, and it really hampered our ability to get them up to an adequate level of proficiency. The Army, on the other hand, was farther along than the police were. And those guys basically lived on one main base inside Ghazni. It was a big old Russian air base that they had taken over since the Russians had left. And I would go to war with those guys anytime.
I want to come back to some of the things you just mentioned in terms of thinking about where this is all going to go in the future, drawing on some of those observations. But let me keep with some basic questions first. This may seem like a strange one, but is there one particular day that stands out in your memory as the best day during your service in Afghanistan, however you want to define best?
Yeah, I would argue it's funny you say that. I think the best day for me was also the day before my worst day. Mm-hmm. And it's just ironic that it happened to be that way. But on April 27th, 2008, was my 13th day in country. It was the first time we went on a mission where we decided that we were going to hand out some humanitarian aid and assistance. We weren't actually out to just hand out food and clothing to starving people. We were actually going out to assess some of the police stations in one of our sub-districts. And we decided that since we were going out there to also pick up some bunk beds that were in a facility that we needed to move them from one facility to the next, and we had this big trailer, we figured, well, why don't we load up the trailer with food, clothing, school supplies, and on the way, since we're going to be basically taking the same road in and the same road out, why don't we basically stop and at the villages on the way in and hand out this aid. And then on the way back, we'll pick up the bunk beds. And so what we did was I got obsessed with it, almost to an addict's level of obsession. We stopped and handed out aid to starving people. And I can't tell you what that experience is like other than to say it is profoundly life-altering. The other thing that we did is we started handing out school supplies. And I learned something the next day on my worst day about how important handing out school supplies were. We can talk about that a little bit if you want.
Tell me about the worst day,
sure.
Too.
So the worst day was April 28th. So on April 27th, on the way back, we actually got attacked, and I got blown up for the first time. And you'd say, well, why isn't that your worst day? Why would you consider that to be your best day? And one was that the explosion missed my vehicle by that much. So I consider that to be a blessing, and that's always a great day when the bad guy misses you. The next day on April 28th.
Well, let me stop you for a second. You said we got blown up,
by a roadside bomb, by an IED.
So you were unharmed, but what happened exactly?
All right. So the road we drive in, unfortunately, was the road that we had to drive out. And so the Taliban knows at that point where you're going to be coming from and how they can attack you. And what ended up happening was on the way back, these kids stopped us and they ran up and they said, to our interpreter, hey, the Taliban are waiting for you down the road in this one village, and then they're going to shoot at you and blow you up with roadside bombs. And the guys that we were replacing had been out to this district many a time and had never had any problems. Like, yeah, the kids always say that. It never happens. Well, this time it happened. And we're going down the road, and there's an S-curve to the left. And so you go to the left, and then it curves back to the right. And as you go through that curve, you actually drop down into a dried-out creek bed called a wadi. And as we were going through that dried-out creek bed, there was this explosion right behind my vehicle and kind of lifted it up, and we dropped back down. We kept driving, and the first thing I yelled out was, who threw a simulator? Because it sounded like an artillery simulator. There's the handheld sort of grenade things that we use in training to simulate roadside bombs. They make a big, loud bang, and that was the only experience I ever had with roadside bombs was in training when it sounded almost exactly like that, but there was all this dust and explosion. And then before anyone can answer me, I saw a guy stick a machine gun out of his house's window and start shooting at us. And he was about 30 meters to my left. And then I watched this mortar round come down and explode next to me. And we realized we were in the middle of an ambush and we were getting shot at from both sides. So we actually were able to drive out of that without too much difficulty. It was a very adrenaline pumping experience. But the fact that we were handing out aid to kids did not dampen. That attack could not ever dampen that experience. It was just so profound. I literally had to be dragged away by a captain of mine. He had to turn and grab me by the shoulders and say, Lieutenant, you can't feed them all, and pulled me away. And I didn't want to stop. It made it my life's mantra at that point for the rest of my tour. Every village we were going to stop in, I was going to be able to hand out something to somebody just to be able to try and improve their existence. On April 28th, we were doing the same thing, essentially. We were going out to assess another police station in a different district. But this district had two roads. So you could come in from the north and leave from the south, which is what we decided to do, or you could come in from the south and leave from the north. This way, the Taliban couldn't predict which way you were going to come in and leave, because you could just turn around and use the same road in that you took out. You could use the same road to get out as you took in. So the problem was that when we went out to this district, none of us had ever been there before, and the guys that we were replacing did not want to go because it was too dangerous. And they had what we called short time syndrome. They knew that they were leaving in a week, and they didn't want to get killed in their last week. And so when we went out there, the maps that we took, we didn't know this at the time, hadn't been updated since 1984. Now, this is 2008, and we have maps that were there, when the Soviets were there. A lot's changed. And the imagery on our satellite imagery that they provided with us to sort of see where we're going from point A to point B hadn't been updated since 1984 either. So we're driving around, with basically, 24-year-old maps that were not in any way accurate. We got lost. We asked a local Afghan farmer for directions. We could see on our GPS we were about 3 kilometers away from the main highway that would take us back to our base, but we were in the middle of nowhere and we didn't know how to get back there. And we were on the outskirts of this village when the lead vehicle in our 3-vehicle convoy hit an IED, a big one, a very large IED, 2 anti-tank mines in the road used as an IED. And it exploded, and we thought all the guys in the vehicle were dead. The explosion was just so large. And thankfully, they weren't. They all had horrific concussions. 2 of them didn't know where they were for the next 48 hours. Our standard operating procedure at that point was to throw what was called a thermite grenade in the back of the vehicle, blow it up, and burn it all down. It melts really hot, destroys all the sensitive items, basically leaves a big paperweight for the villagers. And the battalion commander for the 101st, who was in charge of our area, we didn't belong to the 101st. We weren't part of their unit, but we were attached to them. We had to obey all their orders. They basically, the battalion commander, so their commander of the unit, gets on their radio and he said, if you don't come back without that vehicle, don't bother coming back at all. You will remain there until you're properly relieved. Out. So for the next hour, we sat in this dismounted security perimeter waiting to basically get attacked because we knew it was only a matter of time. And we were rotating. One guy, we all were in foxholes, you know, about 100 meters apart. And there's only 15 of us, and I need to emphasize that for what's going to happen next. So there's 15 of us. We're sort of in this dismounted perimeter, and we were rotating one guy at a time to get off the back of – get out of their foxhole, get in the back of my vehicle, which was still operational, get 5 minutes of air conditioning just to cool down because it was already oppressively hot, and it was only the end of April, get some water, resupply on anything they might need for a long stay in a foxhole, more bullets, stuff like that, and get some food. So it just happened to be my turn to get in the back of the vehicle, and I got in the back, and my interpreter, Fareed, who had been in the first vehicle that got blown up, that was the sixth IED blast he had survived in his life, and he had a horrific concussion. But we needed to keep him conscious to be able to tell the villagers and that we were basically on the outskirts of the village to stay away. And so my medic, Scott, was sitting next to him trying to keep him conscious in the back of this vehicle, and Fareed looks at me when I get in the back, and he says, well, I have to go out and go to the bathroom. And Scott looked at Fareed and said, I got to come with you. So they get out, and I said, I don't want to sit back here by myself. So I said, Fareed, can I bum a cigarette from you? And as I was lighting up the cigarette, there was this massive explosion behind me. I had just gotten out of the back of the vehicle. And the next thing I knew, I was unconscious. Well, I didn't know I was unconscious. The next thing I knew, I'm waking up. I'm on the ground, and I hear these firecracker noises around me. I realized those are bullets because the ground's kicking up, and someone's shooting at me. And what ended up happening was the worst firefight I've ever been in my life. I got blown – that first explosion was a rocket-propelled grenade. I got blown up two more times in that firefight by mortar rounds landing next to me and sending me flying back into a wall. When it was all said and done, we were told later by the people who were watching in the drone overhead that there were 45 members of the Taliban attacking the 15 of us and that they didn't think we were going to make it. And cigarette smoking – I don't smoke now anymore, but that cigarette saved my life because if I hadn't stepped outside to have that cigarette – a rocket-propelled grenade, the one that started the ambush, went through my vehicle and through the seat I had been sitting in 10 seconds prior and would have killed me and split me in half. Yeah, so that was the worst day of my life.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Matt Zeller, author of Watches Without Time, a book about his experiences as an Army officer in Afghanistan. In your book, you draw an interesting distinction between what your chaplain called turtles and ducks, which figures prominently in understanding some of the problems and how war policies that get made at the administrative level get implemented on the ground. Could you just talk a little bit about that distinction and how it factors into things?
Sure. So when we were going through our training in Fort Riley, one of our unit's chaplains came to visit us, and he sat us down by teams. And we were training in these small teams at Fort Riley, you know, about 20 guys each. He sat our team down in a private room, and he said, just going around the room, how many of you guys are war veterans who have actually served in combat? And four guys raised their hands. And he said, all you all are Iraq. And they nodded their heads. And he said, okay. He said, for the rest of you, do you feel like they have a stronger bond with one another, that there's just something different? And we all kind of thought about it. And they said, yeah, there is. There is something different about those four guys. They do seem a little bit closer with each other than the rest of us. And a chaplain who was an Iraq war vet himself said, yeah, that makes sense. That's because they're turtles and you're all ducks. And he said, see, there's two types of people in life. They're the ducks, and most people are ducks. Most people have never ever going to experience combat in their life. And so ducks are emotional, loud, boisterous, fun animals that, you know, just let you know always sort of what they're feeling and thinking. They're able to open up most of the time to people. They're fun people. Ducks love talking to other ducks, and they like to talk to other turtles. The problem is that ducks don't speak turtle. Turtles, on the other hand, do speak duck because they used to be ducks themselves. Every combat veteran's a turtle. And turtles typically, like, really only talking to other turtles. But they'll talk to ducks if they need to. Turtles are more cautious, more careful. But more importantly, they have a tendency to retreat in their shell. Whereas a duck might tell you, hey, I'm not comfortable with this. I'm not feeling right about this. When a turtle gets uncomfortable, rather than letting the world know or somebody know, they retreat in their shell. And they wait for another turtle to come along to bring them out of it. And so how that has profound ramifications is that most members of Congress and our executive administration these days aren't turtles. They're ducks. So they don't understand what it means to actually send somebody off to become a turtle. For them, war is a part of grand decision making and strategy and being in power. But there are profound ramifications. I went to war not eager to be in combat, but I was like, sort of wanting to say, yeah, I could check that box. I was able to get through it. And after the first time someone shot at me, I never wanted to be in it again. I hated it. I hated every aspect of it. I didn't understand how someone could hate me that much that they wanted to remove my existence forever from this planet. I just didn't – I could not get my head around that. I didn't hate these people. I wasn't there to seek revenge for anything. I was angry about, you know, 9/11, and I always felt, okay, if you had Osama bin Laden in front of me, I would be more than happy to put a bullet in his head. But these people that were shooting at me probably had no beef with me whatsoever than the fact that I was there. And I just couldn't understand that. I couldn't wrap my head around it. And I've always wanted to then – that's why I want to see more veterans in leadership positions in our country. We need – war should be the option of ultimate last resort. And I think it really takes a combat veteran to understand exactly what it means to send somebody off to war. It's not just combat that's going to affect them. There are profound ramifications for things that they'll go through for the rest of their lives that will impact their decision. For me personally, I've tried to turn it into a positive. I've decided that I somehow got blessed to keep on going. I didn't get killed, so I treat every day as a blessing. And I always have I tell people, look, any day that nobody's shooting at you is a great day.
Your title is very provocative, Watches Without Time. Can you explain that?
Sure. I had this Taliban detainee that we totally beat him and his buddies in a firefight, and he was one of the only survivors. And a lot of people were probably wondering, you know, what do you do with a guy after he shot at you and you've beaten him and you've captured him and taken him as a prisoner of war or a detainee? And you'd think, you know, you'd want to just punch them, right, for doing that. But once you meet these people, you kind of feel bad for them because on the cover of my book, you can see I'm wearing my full complement of body armor. It was about 70 pounds of body armor. And then I had a brand new, you know, assault rifle with a grenade launcher on it. And I had, you know, any time I was always carrying about 300 rounds of bullets on me and several grenades. And I could always call in an airstrike if I absolutely needed to. And if I got shot, I had a helicopter that would eventually come and pick me up and take me to the world's best, you know, military hospital with the best military doctors who are really doing the angel's work. I mean, these people, emergency medicine has gone so far ahead of where it was 10 years ago because of our war experience. And these guys are amazing people. The Taliban don't have any of that. I got three hot meals a day and sometimes a shower if the water was running properly. The Taliban didn't have any of this. And so this guy that we'd captured, he stank to high heaven. He probably hadn't bathed in months. He was starving. He hadn't eaten in 2 days. He was severely dehydrated, you know. And he had 8 bullets on him. He had 8 bullets. I had 300 when I captured this guy. He had 8 bullets on him. And I was looking at him, and I was just thinking, I finally asked him. I sat him down. I gave him a bottle of water and a sandwich and a cigarette. And I said, can I ask you something? Look at me. Do you really think you can beat me on a – I just beat you and your buddies badly. Some of them are never – they're dead now. They're not coming back. How do you think you're going to beat us? I can call in an airstrike on you. You don't stand a chance. Now, I have two masters from the Maxwell School, which is – we all know is the best on the planet for what it does. I'm highly educated in comparison to this guy. He probably has at best a second grade education, and that was most likely Quranic, meaning he was just – he sat around all day and he literally recited the Quran aloud, and that was considered to be an education. And he looked at me and he pointed at my watch and he said, you Americans have all the watches. We have all the time. That's a profound statement. It's one he's read. He understand. You know, they understand Ho Chi Minh will outbleed you, right? Will outlast you. And if we can outbleed you and outlast you, and we're around when you leave, we've won the war. You might beat us in every single battle, but our existence at the end means we win. But more importantly, a watch is a really complex piece of technology. It's actually a good symbol of human endeavor throughout the centuries, because if you, watches now are you know either digital and they've got a computer chip or they've got a series of levers and dials and that spin around in a complex manner, and we use it to dictate almost every aspect of our life. But what if it didn't measure anything? What if it was just a really complex piece of technology that didn't serve any useful purpose? And that's what he was trying to say, is all of your military might, all the technological prowess that you bring as an advantage, because there's no strategy behind it, doesn't mean anything. I mean, I ask my audiences when I give talks, can anybody identify what is the actual definition of winning in Afghanistan? What constitutes winning? And I've never gotten a response, and because that is there has never been a declared strategy for Afghanistan. The closest we've come to is in the Obama administration, where they say that a victory in Afghanistan is the absence of al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Well, it only takes a handful of guys to stand up and say, we're members of the Taliban, for that entire strategy to fall apart after you've left.
In case you just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and I'm talking with Matt Zeller, author of Watches Without Time. Your book has some brutally honest descriptions of the problems that you went through adjusting when you came back home. And you may be the only former congressional candidate ever to describe the ordeal of a campaign as a therapy that saved your life. How have things gone for you since you wrote those final pages in 2011?
I'm a lot better now than I was before I ran for Congress. I got back from the war, and 2 days after I got back, my girlfriend and I were driving down a road in Northern Virginia that at one point goes from a 2-lane road to a 6-lane road, and then within a mile goes back to a 2-lane road. And we were going down the road, and I wasn't used to civilian traffic, not parting like the Red Sea from my car, because that's what it was in Afghanistan when you drove. They just got out of our way, and we kind of rode down the middle. And when that didn't happen and the road went back to from 6 lanes to 2 lanes and suddenly there was all this traffic merging and they weren't getting out of my way, I instinctively reached to tap my gunner's knee because I'm used to a guy standing with a machine gun and a turret and tell my gunner Private Mendez, hey, point the weapon and tell these people to move. And when I didn't reach Mendez's knee because my Toyota was not equipped with a turret or a gunner, I freaked out. And I don't remember what happened, but the officer who pulled me over 2 miles later says that I was speeding, crossed a double yellow, tried to run two vehicles off the road, blew through two stop signs and a red light. And when he took one look at me, he said, when did you get home? And I said, 3 days ago, 2 days ago, sir. And he said, step out of the car. And I literally stepped out preparing to get arrested. And he then asked my girlfriend to step out. And I turned to him and said, hey, she hasn't done anything. And he said, no, you don't understand. You go sit in the passenger seat. And then he sat my girlfriend down in the driver's seat. And he looked and he said, he's not allowed to drive. Take him to the VA. I went in and was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, a traumatic brain injury, and a couple other issues. And then the VA, I'm supposed to get free health care for these things for at least 5 years, if not for life. And then the VA tried to bill me for it. And when I called up and said, hey, listen, I'm not supposed to be billed for these things, they apologized and said, you're right, you're absolutely not. And then they garnished my taxes for the treatment that I was receiving. So I stopped going to the VA because I was really, really angry. And I started drinking heavily. Very heavily, and doing all the things that you're not supposed to do, closing off, not talking to my friends, not seeking out other veterans, to just open myself up to back to life. And by the time it was, I actually left. At this point, I was also working for the CIA. By the time I left the CIA to run for Congress, I had a full-blown drinking problem. And the rigor of running for Congress, the time that I had to put in, did not, if I wanted to have any chance of success, did not afford me the opportunity, the time in the day to sit down and consume a large amount of alcohol. Because I was doing it not because I was trying to feel better or anything. I was doing it so that I could fall asleep and not have the same nightmare I've had for 5 years. I wanted to not remember my nightmare at night. And I was doing all the wrong things. But that run not only forced me to basically focus my energies elsewhere other than getting hammered at night, it forced me to come out of my shell and talk to people and start telling my story. It became so therapeutic that I couldn't imagine
– Return to the world of ducks.
Yeah. I couldn't imagine where my life would have gone if I hadn't done that experience, because I was forced to basically be an extrovert. And I'm actually very extroverted, but – for this year of my life after I got back, I was an extreme introvert. I didn't think anyone would ever understand me. I was sort of this veteran on his mountain saying, none of you get it, and I don't want to be here. I wanted to go back to Afghanistan desperately because I felt that I was never going to have a job that was more meaningful than the one that I had in 2008. And since that run, I lost the election, but it was so therapeutic. It changed my life forever. I don't have a drinking problem anymore. I don't do it. I go to the VA now twice a week, three times a month to either sit down with a veterans group or a personal counselor and talk my things out. I would, if any veterans listening and you're not doing that, you need to go and talk to somebody because we all have things that we should be discussing, even if you don't think they're important, they are. But yeah, that experience saved my life. It really did.
And what are you up to right now?
I was part of the contract workforce in D.C. that recently a lot of people don't realize are very quietly being laid off with the impending budget crisis. And I'm actually glad because I actually hated the job. So I got laid off in July, and I consider it a blessing because the book at that point had just come out, and it freed me up with a bunch of time to go and talk at different schools. So I've been doing a lot of talks here at Syracuse last semester at Harvard, UCLA. I'm going to Columbia and Hamilton College and a couple other places this semester. In addition to that, I have been helping a bunch of veterans groups in the Rochester, Buffalo area try to think about how they can better officer services to veterans returning from the wars who want to then go to college and then graduate with a job, which is an extremely important thing to solve because one out of every four veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan who go to college fail out their first semester, and 88% of veterans who go back to school after serving in the wars will fail out before graduation. That's astronomical. And what we've also found is that the veterans unemployment rate is around 16% nationally. But if you get a veteran who's done at least one tour in Iraq or Afghanistan and you give them they're able to earn a four-year degree, that unemployment rate drops from 16% to 3.5%. So, these are my brothers and sisters. They need help. And so I've been sort of dedicating my time to do that. And I'm a fellow for two think tanks in Washington. I get to write a bunch of policy papers that go to senior people in the administration and hopefully have an impact. So we'll see.
What you just said there toward the end directly leads into something else I wanted to ask you. There's been a lot of writing and conversation about what the government can realistically be doing to help returning war veterans that it's not doing now. But I wanted to ask you, what can we as citizens be doing on our own that you think would help folks like you when they get back?
They tell us as veterans to talk to civilians, right? And I would encourage civilians to talk to veterans. And there's a couple of things you never ask, like, did you kill anybody? What was it like, to get shot at? We'll tell you in our own time if we really want to. It's interesting. We're a generation that came back and everyone thanks us for our service. And that's awesome because it didn't happen in Vietnam. That I can't say how wonderful that is. It really is meaningful to be thanked for that. But get to know a veteran. And if you have the opportunity to hire a veteran, you'll never find a better employee. We show up early. We leave late. We're team players. We're goal-oriented. We don't give lip or talk back or anything like that. And we're all about getting the job done and exceeding your expectations. And finally, befriend a veteran. Sometimes all it takes is one person reaching out to somebody that just opens up their world for them. And you might not realize it's important to them, but I know plenty of my guys who have just had very good happenstance. So they've run into some – at one point it was a stranger, now a dear friend of theirs who was a civilian and just said, oh, you served – hey, why don't I get a cup of coffee? And a friendship's blossom. And what they don't realize is that they're encountering one of my brothers and sisters at probably one of the lowest points of their lives where they're really not talking to anybody. They might be unemployed. Some of them might even be homeless, couch surfing. And that experience, that relationship saves them. It brings them back into the world of being a duck.
I got a bottom line kind of question for you here about America's experiences in Afghanistan and Iraq, taking everything into consideration, all the expenses, all the losses of life on all sides, do you think our interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan have been worth the cost?
Not in Iraq. I don't discredit or discount anyone's service. I thank them profoundly. Again, as the military, we don't get to choose policy. We just execute it. But that was, I think, was a war of choice. It was an unnecessary war of choice. It's had profound ramifications for the region. Iran doesn't have now a counterweight And that's why we have this more bellicose Iran that we have to worry about. The number of fighters that were trained in that conflict that have gone on to cause problems elsewhere, Libya, Mali, Yemen, Syria, the freedom fighters in Syria are something else that we were fighting against in Iraq. And they got some of their training fighting against us, which is interesting because now the enemy of my enemy is my friend, which makes strange bedfellows. I also think that Afghanistan is a war, and that's sort of the central point of my book. Or one of the central points is I think Afghanistan as a war profoundly suffered to the point that we're probably going to end up not having what we want at the end state in Afghanistan when we leave because of our intervention in Iraq, because it deviated so many resources, financial, personnel, logistics, and just even attention away from a war that had not yet been really won definitively. And that's unfortunate. I do think our intervention in Afghanistan, however, has had benefit, and I'd like to hope that it will have benefit. But I say that because if I try to look at it objectively, I can't, because every time I think about us leaving Afghanistan and it collapsing, the only person I really focus on is my interpreter, Janus, who's a male, J-A-N-U-S. He saved my life twice, and he's a patriot, both of our country and his own, for what he's done. And Janus is one of the first people that will probably get killed for his involvement with us if we don't leave Afghanistan better than we found it. And I know that the war is unpopular, and I don't want to see anybody else die, but I just keep coming back to it. We owe Janus and his family better.
Let me get to the three questions at the end. First, what's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
Transitions.
Second, what's your worst trait?
I talk too much.
And third, what professional or creative achievement in your life so far has surprised you the most?
Actually, I revise my worst trait. I wear my heart on my sleeve too much. The professional achievement that surprised me the most, I never thought I'd run for Congress at the age of 28. I really didn't. And it was just by pure luck and fortune and random circumstance and tenacity, I guess, on my part and others. Very few people run for office at 28.
That was Matt Zeller. Matt, I will thank you, too, for your service, and thank you for talking with me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm Grant Reher. Join me again next week for more conversation in the public interest on the WRVO stations.